The FBI had tried to shake Rosenberg, but he had not budged. He would not admit to anything. Sensing their loss of confidence, Rosenberg finally asked to call a lawyer. "Ask the FBI if you are under arrest," the lawyer instructed. Rosenberg put the question to his interrogators, and they conceded he was not. "Then pick yourself up and come down to our office," the lawyer advised. Rosenberg rose from his chair, and, after giving the agents a bow, whose formality was nothing but mocking, turned on his heels and left. He undoubtedly felt he'd handled himself well. He had taken all their shots, rebuffed all their questions, and he had not revealed anything. But in the course of questioning, Rosenberg had absently mentioned his wife's name, and this small disclosure would come back to haunt him even before the day was over. They sat side by side around a conference table that was very much like the one in Foley Square, only this one was in the Justice Department building in Washington. Jim McInerney, a shrewd former FBI man who now headed the Justice Department's criminal division, presided, and Bob, along with Belmont and Ladd, were the Bureau's representatives. Experience had taught Bob that these discussions were too often tugs of war between the FBI and the justice lawyers over whether the Bureau had built a sturdy enough case against a suspect to prosecute, and over the years Bob had come out on the losing end of these arguments more times than he liked to recall. This morning, his nerves jangling from too little sleep and too much coffee, he'd entered the arena with his mind set to put up an epic fight. He knew that at the same time in New York, both Greenglass and Rosenberg were being interrogated, and he was going to do all he could to make sure they weren't turned loose. The chance that either of them might flee before he had a chance to prove whether they were operatives in the network he and Meredith had been pursuing made him reckless. His temper was famous, and even though he was the lowest-ranking man in the room, he was ready to let it fly. He took measure of the government lawyers, and all he could see were newcomers, and not very knowledgeable ones at that, to what had for so long been his own personal mission. But no sooner had Bob settled into his seat, and the latest summaries of the talkative Greenglass's post-breakfast revelations had been passed around, than it became apparent that everyone was of the same mind, at least regarding one of the suspects. Greenglass had revealed that Rosenberg had introduced him to a Soviet agent who had asked me questions about a high-explosive lens which was being experimented with at the Los Alamos bomb project. Justice was all on board with charging the former soldier with conspiracy to convey to another country information vital to the national defense of the United States. As Bob listened, the call was made to the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, requesting that Greenglass be taken into custody. With that done, the discussion moved on to Ruth Greenglass and Julius Rosenberg. Greenglass had implicated both of them, but McInerney argued that without additional supporting evidence, there was no case against the couple. Ruth, he pointed out, hadn't even been questioned. She was still in the hospital. And as for Rosenberg, the agents in New York reported he was holding strong, not admitting to anything. Bob, as if on cue, erupted. "We can't let him run. There's too much at stake," he insisted, more emphatically than he knew was appropriate. Perhaps, then, it was simply to give his friend a moment to pull himself together that Mickey Ladd spoke up. He patiently made the case that it was unlikely Rosenberg would try to escape. He had a family, two children, and his wife was David Greenglass's sister. "Ethel," he added, after consulting one of the pages in front of him. The discussion continued, but Bob no longer had any awareness of the debate. In his mind he was transported back to Meredith's office. And there was the codebreaker in his soft yet confident voice sharing his latest special study. "Intelligence on Liberal's wife. surname that of her husband, Christian name Ethel, 29 years old. Bob knew he had at last found Liberal. At that instant he knew he would break the ring. And with that sudden, heartening understanding, with his thoughts focused on the investigations he'd need to launch, Bob's anger seeped away. He sat there mutely, the conversation swirling around him. All his thoughts were centered on the attack he'd lead, on the KGB cables filled with code names he hoped to soon untangle. When the meeting concluded, and the decision had been made that process should not be issued at this time against Ruth Greenglass and Julius Rosenberg, his reaction was restrained. Then he hurried back to his desk, eager to share what he had just learned with his friend at Arlington Hall. "Discreet surveillance?" Bob bellowed incredulously to Al Belmont. The Bureau's lackadaisical policy made no sense, he argued, his temper once again ignited. A month had passed since Greenglass's initial confession, and while Bob had begun to make progress in identifying other members of the ring, he had also grown increasingly concerned that Liberal would slip away before he finished the job. Yet the Bureau was only maintaining a half-hearted watch on Rosenberg. Worse, Bob knew from reading the New York agents' reports that the Knickerbocker Village housing project, where Rosenberg lived, was a surveillance nightmare. The buildings were connected by a maze of underground passageways. An army of watchers would be put to the test if Rosenberg took it into his head to flee. A few agents, most of them working straight 9-to-5 shifts, could never get the job done. Bob came to work every morning, he confided to Belmont, waiting to hear the news that Rosenberg had fled, vanished into thin air. But Belmont said his hands were tied. The fifth floor was working with justice on this, and the official position, frustrating as it might be to Bob, was that there wasn't sufficient evidence to move against Rosenberg. Greenglass's initial confessions were not enough, and apparently, on the advice of his attorney, who was busy trying to work out a plea deal, he'd stopped talking. Bob shuffled off in disgust. He had the evidence to convict Rosenberg. It was there in the cables that Meredith had decoded, the incriminating words screaming at him. Only the government wouldn't allow the decrypted messages to be introduced as evidence in court. It could not be revealed that Arlington Hall had cracked the Soviets' code. Hell, even the president had not been told about Venona. The intelligence brass would rather the ringleader of a KGB spy network escaped than let the Russians know we had read their mail. It was sheer madness. To be this close and yet unable to claim his rightful victory left Bob deeply demoralized. Then, on July 17th, even though a plea deal had not yet been fully negotiated, both of the Greenglasses started talking once again. The husband's statement ran for 7 typed, single-spaced pages, and for the first time he portrayed Rosenberg as the linchpin in a network of Soviet spies. He claimed his brother-in-law had contacts with scientists and engineers, his boys, Rosenberg had proudly called them, and made regular deliveries of microfilm documents to Russian couriers. He'd even stolen a highly classified proximity fuse from his job at Emerson Radio. And Rosenberg had repeatedly urged him to run, giving him money as well as sharing an escape plan the Soviets had devised. Ruth Greenglass's statement was, in its own bitter way, no less damning of her brother-in-law, but more significant, it also, for the first time, made accusations against Ethel Rosenberg. She said that her sister-in-law had been present when Rosenberg had asked her to persuade David to make scientific information available to the Russians. In fact, she claimed, Ethel told me I should at least ask her husband to spy. Bob read these statements as soon as they came in over the teletype. After only his quick initial read, he was certain that he had just been handed the evidence he needed. but just in case he read them again. Finally satisfied, he confronted Al Belmont, gave him a quick summary of the smoking guns he was holding, and asked Belmont to accompany him. The sticklers at justice would pay a lot more attention to an assistant director than to a supervisor. The two of them confronted Jim McInerney in his office. McInerney had grown up on the streets of New York, a tough Irish kid who had made it, against all odds, to Fordham Law School, and he still had a lot of fight left in him. If the two bureau men thought they were going to steamroll him to reverse his original decision not to prosecute Rosenberg, they were in for a battle. But after he read the new statements, he was a convert. He told them to have the New York field office issue a complaint and an arrest warrant for Julius Rosenberg. There was not, however, sufficient evidence to charge Ethel Rosenberg. So far, as McInerney saw the case, it appears there would be just one witness against Ethel to show her complicity, which witness would be Ruth. And that, Bob thought to himself, was how he saw things, too. He still remembered the deciphered cable, Christian name Ethel. In view of her delicate health, she does not work. At 6:45 in the evening of that same day, seven agents marched into the Knickerbocker Village apartment and arrested Julius Rosenberg. His 8-year-old son, Michael, had been listening to the Lone Ranger on the radio. One of the agents abruptly turned the set off. It was a small, petty gesture, but he apparently felt it was nevertheless a necessary one. The boy, his father's son, turned the radio back on. Bob received the news on August 7th that Ethel Rosenberg would be summoned before the grand jury. The government's evidence against her, he knew better than anyone, consisted of only Ruth Greenglass's assertions. And he still remembered enough of his law school classes to know that hearsay was inadmissible. So he'd been surprised that she'd been subpoenaed, and then further taken aback to learn that she had invoked the Fifth Amendment rather than testify. 4 days later, Ethel Rosenberg was summoned again. This time she was told if she would not answer questions, she would be charged with conspiracy. She refused and was arrested. Sitting at his desk in Washington, Bob thought about the Justice Department's strategy. Perhaps her indictment was a way to ramp up the pressure, to get her to talk. After all, she must have known about her husband's activities. A case for conspiracy, Bob had to admit, could reasonably be made. But at the same time, he recalled something Meredith had pointed out. Moscow Center had not considered her significant enough to have a code name. Christian name Ethel does not work. Yet Ruth Greenglass's complicity had been obvious to the Russians. The KGB had given her the code name Wasp, and she was not facing any charges. Bob told himself nothing would come of Ethel Rosenberg's indictment. Only later, he'd say, would he remember another moment that happened just days after this indictment. His eyes had strayed to a newspaper on an adjacent desk at headquarters. The headline was about the fighting in Korea. The conflict was less than 2 months old and going badly for the UN command, led by over 100,000 U.S. troops. Nearly every day American soldiers were dying in a war that many believed would not have come about if an emboldened Russia had not had its own atomic weapon to brandish. And by the time that memory rose up in his mind, Bob had lost all his previous certainty about Ethel Rosenberg's fate. Instead, he found himself grappling with the sickening notion that this nation, feeling threatened, might prove to be as ruthless and vindictive as its enemies. 37. In the incredibly hectic weeks that followed the Greenglass confession and the Rosenberg arrest, Bob had the gratifying sense that his life had come full circle. The perplexing mysteries from his past, once shoved aside in frustration, had now returned, but with a new clarity. He had believed all along that the clues Meredith had assembled from the cables would lead straight into the clandestine heart of Soviet operations in America, but he'd been unable to make sense of them. Now, he would recall, many things we had struggled for several years to understand in the deciphered KGB messages became clear. With this new hard-won knowledge, he at last had the keys to unlock the doors that protected a covert kingdom, and he went to work. Moving forward, it quickly became evident that one dormant clue was intertwined with another. And with Bob's first firm shove, the long-running network began to topple. Antenna was sent by the firm to work in Carthage. There he visited his school friend Max Elitcher, who works in the Bureau of Standards. Now, Bob understood, it was Julius Rosenberg who had contacted Max Elitcher in Washington and tried to recruit him. 2 years ago, Bob had futilely tried to mine this faint clue with the ineffective tools of background checks and surveillance. This time, however, when FBI agents, armed with a lot more than shadowy suspicions, brought Elitcher down to Foley Square for questioning in the days after Rosenberg's arrest, he began to open up. On the first day of questioning, Elitcher confirmed that he had 6 to 8 conversations with Rosenberg about giving information concerning secret material and developments to the Russians. Elitcher maintained he had simply found his old school friend's offers flattering. He had never cooperated. But Bob didn't buy it. Would Rosenberg, clearly a careful operative, keep trying to recruit Elitcher? Would he continue to put himself and the entire network at risk, only to be rebuffed time after time? That sort of recklessness went against everything Bob knew about Soviet tradecraft. Keep pressing, Bob ordered. When the agents confronted Elitcher the next day, he still refused to incriminate himself, but he quickly gave up his friend Morton Sobel. Rosenberg, he said, had told him that Sobel had already been supplying information, which, Bob noted as he sifted through the transcript of the interview, was precisely what he had suspected years earlier. Only back then, making a case against Sobel had been beyond his grasp. Now, seeing all his labors finally beginning to bear fruit, he experienced, he'd remember, a sense of closure and completeness. But in the next moment a new thought supplanted all the others, and his satisfaction was abruptly undermined. If we had gone ahead and picked up Elitcher and questioned closely after our surveillance in 1948, he chastised himself, the entire ring might have been broken so much earlier. It had been a squandered opportunity, and Bob felt he was to blame. The self-recriminations persisted. When Bob gave the order to bring Sobel in for questioning, the agents couldn't find him. He wasn't at work. Neither he nor his family was at home. Sobel, Bob suddenly suspected with a terrible sense of foreboding, had flown the coop. Once again, Bob fixed ample blame on himself for not having anticipated this turn of events. After all, he berated himself, hadn't Greenglass disclosed that the Russians had been trying to get him to Moscow by a complicated escape route that originated in Mexico? And no sooner had Bob's thoughts returned to that discarded intelligence morsel than he decided, more in an act of desperation than even a hunch, that he had stumbled on a plan of attack. At least it was worth a try, he told himself. A check of airline offices revealed that Sobel, along with his wife and 2 children, had purchased tickets to Mexico City on July 22nd, 5 days after Rosenberg's arrest. Bob received that news and immediately suffered another pang of guilt. By now the Sobels must be on their way to Moscow. The task of finding them would be, he realistically conceded, almost impossible. Nevertheless, with a perfunctory diligence, he sent instructions to the Bureau liaison officer in Mexico City to be on the lookout for Sobel. And they found him. Sobel was subsequently spotted leaving the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. He had not informed the New York residentura of his plans to run, and so he'd been frantically hustling about Mexico, trying to book passage on a freighter, while also checking in from time to time at the Soviet embassy to see if they'd received word from Moscow Center confirming that he was the secret operative he'd claimed to be. He was having a late supper in his rented apartment on Calle Octavo de Córdoba when three Spanish-speaking men, waving pistols menacingly, took him into custody for robbing a bank in Acapulco. Hurled into the back seat of a waiting car, his wife and children forced into another vehicle, the caravan sped non-stop the entire 800 miles to the Texas border. Sobel was promptly transferred into the custody of a waiting squad of FBI agents and charged with 5 overt acts of having conspired with Julius Rosenberg and others to violate the espionage statute. When Bob picked up his phone in Washington to hear the jubilant agent in Laredo announce the arrest, he understood at once just how improbable this victory had been. What were the chances that Sobel hadn't already made his furtive way deep behind the Iron Curtain? What were the odds that a long-time spy, without disguise or any attempt at subterfuge, would walk straight out the front door of the Soviet embassy? Nevertheless, the arrest went a long way toward soothing the corrosive guilt that had been eating into him since he'd come to realize he should have pursued the Elitcher connection with more operational vigor years earlier. In this firmer mood, he continued his attack on the ring. Gnome deserves remuneration for material no less valuable than that given by the rest of the members of the liberal group who were given bonus by you. Please agree to paying him $500. That message, sent from the New York KGB station on September 14, 1944, had left both Bob and Meredith puzzled, since it had first been partially decrypted in 1948. Who was Gnome? And what, this is a more unnerving question, had he delivered to Liberal that the parsimonious spymasters at Moscow Center deemed worthy of a $500 bonus? The only clue that Meredith had been able to claw out of the cables was that Gnome did not live in New York. But now, when Bob returned to this mystery, he did so fortified by the certainty that Gnome and all the operatives in the ring were interrelated and that the linchpin had been Julius Rosenberg. Once again, Bob went back over ground that he had trodden years ago. But from his new perspective, the evidence took on a more incriminating shape. William Pearl, an authority on the design of supersonic aircraft, lived and worked in Cleveland, and had gone to school with Julius Rosenberg. He had sublet an apartment from Alfred Sarant and was friends with Joel Barr, two other suspects Bob had chased without success. And, Bob was now convinced, Pearl was Gnome, a spy on Moscow Center's payroll. Yet when questioned by the FBI, Pearl wouldn't break. He was innocent, he protested, snarling with indignation through several rounds of interrogation. Bob read the interviews and was near to admitting defeat. How can I win, he asked himself, if I must be restrained by such stringent rules? If he couldn't reveal the existence of the Arlington Hall decrypts, he doubted he'd be able to make a solid espionage case against Pearl. But Pearl saved Bob the trouble of having to continue his chase. In sworn testimony before a grand jury on August 18, 1950, Pearl denied knowing either Julius Rosenberg or Morton Sobel. "Gotcha," Bob told himself with a genuine satisfaction. He immediately went to work building a perjury case, a crime punishable by 5 years' imprisonment for each count, against Noam. Which left Bob with the two good friends he'd tried without success to identify years ago, codenames Hughes and Meter, mentioned in a November 1944 cable. Liberal has safely carried through the contracting of Hughes. Hughes is a good friend of Meter. We propose to pair them off and get them to photograph their own materials. Now, when Bob did his sums, he realized that his earlier suspicions had been pointing him in the right direction. He had been on their trail, although he hadn't fully comprehended their significance at the time. At this moment, though, like someone who has finally adjusted the lens of his telescope, he saw it all clearly. Joel Barr was Meter. Alfred Sarant was Hughes. But now, when Bob made the connections that directly tied the two friends to Julius Rosenberg and his ring, it was too late. When Bob had last tried to locate Barr, he'd discovered Barr was abroad, perhaps living in Finland, and he'd routinely passed the inquiry into the electrical engineer's whereabouts on to the CIA. But then Bob had become caught up in the tempest of activity that surrounded the Fuchs and Gold investigations. All concerns about Barr were, quite reasonably, or so it had seemed at that naive time, superseded by other priorities. Now Barr was once again in Bob's crosshairs. He traced him in the summer of 1950 to a rented villa in Neuilly, outside Paris. An urgent cable was dispatched to the bureau liaison officer in the American Embassy in Paris, and he rushed out to Neuilly, only to find Barr was gone. From Washington, Bob sent cable after frantic cable, demanding that the agent pursue all leads, dig into every clue. In the wishful part of his mind, Bob wanted to believe that, as in the Sobel case, he'd get lucky. But it was already too late. In the days after Greenglass's arrest, the KGB had swiftly guided Barr to Switzerland, and then put him on a train that carried him deep behind the Iron Curtain into the safety of Prague. Bob resigned himself to settle for Sarant. He'd build an espionage case against the engineer. But once again he found his efforts hampered because the Arlington Hall decrypts, unimpeachable evidence, could not be revealed. His hope was that when pressure was applied, Sarant would either confess or incriminate himself. Therefore, on July 18, 1950, he sent agents from the Albany Bureau office to Sarant's home in Ithaca, New York, with the explicit orders to turn the screws. They worked away at him with increasing success. At first, Sarant insisted he barely knew Rosenberg. By the end of the interview, however, he wearily conceded that perhaps he had been sounded out about working for the Soviets by Rosenberg. But, he told the agents haughtily, I did not bite. Bob read the transcript of this interview and grew encouraged. It would not be long before Sarant broke, he predicted. Sarant undoubtedly reached a similar conclusion. The week after the FBI had shown up at his house, he made his escape. Leaving his own wife behind, he and his neighbor's wife drove by a circuitous route into Mexico. Shrewdly, he made no attempt to contact the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. He expected it would be carefully watched. Instead, he reached out to the Polish embassy. Under their protection, the couple hid out in Mexico for 6 tense months. A Moscow Center-designed escape route at last led him to Guatemala, then on to Spain, and finally to Russia. Bob knew none of this, however. All he knew was that the agent, codenamed Hughes, had somehow managed to disappear, and the loss stung. But there were still two provocative leads lingering from Meredith's handiworks. the agents codenamed Mlod and Star. With absolute certainty, Bob knew that Ted Hall and Saville Sachs were guilty. The Venona decrypts had established their espionage. But once more, even as he outwardly appeared to be moving forward, he felt the strong pull of the restraints that continued to hold him back. Meredith's discoveries could not be revealed. The government had decreed that the continued secrecy of the covert work at Arlington Hall was still a higher priority for the nation's security than any of the secrets it had uncovered. Hall and Sachs would be allowed to live out their lives without paying penalty for their treason. And Bob, despite all his years of striving to stem the flow of evil, would have to live with an awareness of his inability to fulfill his mission. In his struggle to defeat the nation's enemies, he was beginning to suspect that there would always be unfinished business. I was both a bit frustrated and quite pleased. That was how Bob summed up his continually seesawing state of mind as he made his final push against Soviet operations in America. There was, however, one action that he took in these variable days that gave him no qualms. As the conspiracy trial of the Rosenbergs, Sobel, and David Greenglass moved closer, Bob made a trip to Arlington Hall. He made his way across the campus to Meredith's office, and it is easy to imagine that on this auspicious day his thoughts traveled back to his first visits, to his unproductive, almost hostile encounters with the reticent codebreaker. Yet despite only the flimsiest of shared motives, they had managed to find a way to work in tandem, each growing to appreciate the other's judgment and cunning. Against all odds, or even logic, they had conspired together to do the impossible day after day. They had succeeded in running a dangerous, consequential network of the enemy's spies to ground, and in the process, paying whatever price was demanded, making whatever sacrifice was required, they had also discovered the rewards of a sustaining friendship. As if to mark the end of their common quest, Bob arrived carrying a gift. In the past, it was Meredith who had produced the special studies. Now Bob, wanting to reciprocate, had written one for his friend. It was addressed Lamphere to Gardner, and titled Study of Codenames in KGB Communications. He handed it to the codebreaker, and Meredith began to read. It has been determined that one Julius Rosenberg is probably identical with the individual described as Antenna and Liberal. It is also believed now that David Greenglass is identical with the individual described as Caliber, and that Ruth Prince Greenglass is identical with the individual known under the code name OSA. More complete details concerning these individuals will be furnished to you at a later date. When Meredith completed his reading, he had little to say. His silence was testimony to the momentousness of the occasion, and a tribute to the mysteries that had been finally solved. Full of purpose, he went to his filing cabinet and removed his large pile of decrypted messages and placed them on his desk. Sorting through the stack, he found a relevant cable. He inserted it in his typewriter. A line of dashes was typed across the bottom of the page. Then he typed, "Comments." Next, he began to annotate the message to reflect his new information. He added the first footnote. OSA, i.e., WASP, Ruth Greenglass. Then he moved on to the next, and with each typed revision, their long journey proceeded to its final destination. And all the while as he typed, Bob looked on with a keen concentration, proud and, in truth, overwhelmed. as their mutual accomplishment made its way onto the page and into history. 38. Then there was the trial. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and Morton Sobel were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. David Greenglass had already pleaded guilty and was awaiting sentencing. His wife was never charged. It began on a gray, bleak morning, March 6, 1951, in room 107 in the U.S. courthouse in Manhattan. Bob, from his desk at headquarters in Washington, followed the events closely. Sasha, on his morning subway ride to Moscow Center, would read the daily accounts TASS, the Soviet news agency, had prepared for the Russian press. As the proceedings played out, both men, the FBI counterintelligence agent who, after learning about the existence of Liberals' network in a decoded Soviet cable, had led the hunt for the spies, and the KGB handler who had run the network, began to wish for the same conclusion. Both hoped Julius and Ethel Rosenberg would confess. Bob wanted the Rosenbergs to tell the Bureau everything they knew. He wanted to get on with his job, to chase down the operatives who had eluded him. He believed that with the Rosenbergs' cooperation, he could return to the cables, ferret out more clues, and at the end of this renewed chase he'd be able, he confidently predicted, to arrest 10 or 15 more people. Sasha, from his isolation a world away in the corridors of the Lubyanka, found himself reduced to imagining heartfelt conversations with his dear old Libby and Ethel. "What harm would a confession do?" he would plead. "The Americans can't touch us. Yatskov, myself, we're safe beyond the enemy's clutches." Both men, as they watched the trial move forward toward its inevitable conclusion, wanted the Rosenbergs to save themselves. The penalty for conspiracy to commit espionage could be death. The trial was short, just 3 weeks. Only 3 witnesses were called to testify against the Rosenbergs: David and Ruth Greenglass and Harry Gold. Neither Julius nor Ethel Rosenberg would confess. At 11 a.m. on March 29, 1951, after a single night's deliberation, the foreman read the unanimous verdict. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and Morton Sobel were guilty as charged. Judge Irving Kaufman announced that the sentencing would take place on April 5th. "Those 8 days were among the most difficult in my life," Sasha would recall. Meredith was stunned. "I never wanted to get anyone in trouble," he would tell people, his voice nearly breaking with despair. He had consciously chosen a life of the mind, a world of cerebral puzzles and intellectual pleasures. But now he was caught up in something very real and very troubling, and he blamed his own vanity for goading him on. He did not want the spoils, the praise, not at this cost. Bob, in his practical way, did what he felt he could by drafting a memo that Hoover would pass on to Judge Irving Kaufman. A death sentence for Julius Rosenberg might be correct, but only if it was accompanied by the judges announcing that it would be reduced if Rosenberg cooperated fully with the FBI. No purpose, he argued, would be achieved by sentencing Ethel Rosenberg to death. On the morning of the sentencing, Judge Kaufman looked sternly down from his seat on the bench at the defendants, and then spoke. "I believe your conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb, years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb, has already caused, in my opinion, the communist aggression in Korea, with the resultant casualties exceeding 50,000. And who knows but what millions more innocent people may pay for the price of your treason. Indeed, by the cause of your betrayal, you undoubtedly have altered the course of history to the disadvantage of our country." Morton Sobel received a 30-year prison term. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were both condemned to die in the electric chair. And both Bob and Meredith knew beyond any doubt the wrongness of Ethel Rosenberg's death sentence. Christian name Ethel does not work. They had seen the uncontestable proof with their own eyes, the source unimpeachable. Only they had been ordered to keep this knowledge secret. If they were to betray what they knew, write a revealing letter to the judge, perhaps the president, or even slip an informed hint to a reporter, they would be committing treason. Their dilemma, in its broad challenges, they came to appreciate with a ghastly sense of recognition, was not unlike the one that Julius Rosenberg and the other operatives in the ring had faced when they had decided to work for the Soviet cause. Either they could throw everything over to follow a grand moral principle, care nothing about compromise, the opinion of others, reduce their lives to the one thing that mattered, or they could do nothing. In the weeks, then months, that followed, as the appeals worked their tedious way through the courts, both Bob and Meredith tried to believe that the Rosenbergs would confess. They would save their own lives, and in the process spare the two men who had so avidly hunted them. Neither of the men had any misgivings about rooting out traitors. Justice, they felt with a patriotic certainty, demanded that the Rosenbergs and the members of their ring be punished. But vengeance was something else entirely, and now the two friends were left grappling with a sophism that struck at the core of their own lives. They had embarked on their shared quest, determined to stop the progress of evil. But if they did nothing when they possessed the truth, if they allowed a woman, a mother of two young sons, to die, they would be reinforcing all that they knew was wrong. And with their inaction, they would be condemning themselves to another sort of death sentence. Epilogue. A Toast. At 8 p.m. on a warm June evening in 1953, Julius Rosenberg was strapped into the oak-paneled electric chair in the Sing Sing prison death chamber. One electrode was fastened to his leg, another covered the shaved crown of his head. The switch was thrown at 8:04. 2 minutes later, he was pronounced dead. A guard mopped up the urine that had collected under the seat. He used a pneumonia solution, but its sharp smell was not sufficient to cloak the lingering odor of burning flesh. Ethel Rosenberg was brought into the death chamber minutes later and strapped into the chair. At 8:11, 2,000 volts of electricity jolted her body 3 times in rapid succession. But her heart remained beating, and so 2 additional surges were administered. At 8:16, she was finally dead. Both died without making any confessions. Sasha, bereft, blamed the KGB. The spymasters should have taken the necessary steps to have helped the Rosenbergs escape. But if that had been too difficult to organize in time, then his country could have intervened at the trial. The USSR should have openly declared that Julius Rosenberg and Morton Sobel had passed on electronic secrets that were used in the struggle against Nazi Germany, he complained to his friend Anatoly after he had heard the horrible news. It would have told the Americans the truth. They were not atomic spies. And it would have sent a message to Libby, letting him know he was freed from any obligation to keep silent. His agent, his friend, could have confessed and saved his own life, as well as his wife's. Bob heard the news in Mickey Ladd's office, where a direct line to Sing Sing had been installed. From his vantage point by the window, his eyes darted from the silent phone to the darkening sky closing in on the courtyard 5 floors below. He had lost all hope by the time the news arrived, but nevertheless it came as a shock. As he was walking out of the office, one of the agents made a joke, something crude and grisly about burning flesh. Bob whirled on him, fist clenched. But then he realized there was no longer any point. and nothing he could do, no punch he could throw, would lessen the immense sense of guilt he felt. He turned and left without a word, suddenly feeling very alone. Meredith could not sleep after he heard the news. He was sitting in his armchair in the living room, reading, when his wife, after realizing he wasn't in bed, had discovered him just before dawn. Blanche knew better than to ask why he was awake. She simply picked up her own book, sat in her armchair, and, pretending to read, kept her husband company as the light of the new day began to spread across the sky. It took 2 years, and Bob put the blame on a series of bureaucratic indignities when he quit the Bureau in July 1955. The truth was, however, as he'd later acknowledge, that in the aftermath of the Rosenbergs' execution, his heart was no longer in his playing spycatcher. That was why, rather than head to the CIA, which had offered him a top-level position when the news of his departure from the Bureau had begun circulating around the intelligence community, he decided to take a job at the Veterans Administration. He had had enough of the heavy responsibilities that went hand in hand with the secret life. As for Meredith, he too needed to get away. The memories of what he had done at Arlington Hall and its unforeseen consequences were too raw. In his private notebooks, home to a madcap scattering of thoughts big and small, one jotting stood out with an eerie prominence. "I hope the Rosenberg sons won't get on my trail and come around with a gun," he had written. Anyway, he made sure he was soon beyond their reach. When the chance came to work abroad, breaking codes at the Cheltenham facility in England, he took it without hesitation. He was eager to leave, to put a physical distance between himself and all the reminders of his complicitous silence. Sasha, still the professional, his role as the handler of the Rosenberg ring still a secret from the opposition, returned to America just before the 1960 presidential election. He had diplomatic cover, but he was, as he had always been, a spy. In recognition of his work, he had been appointed the Washington, D.C. resident, running operations out of the Soviet embassy on 16th Street. And each day, as he set in motion new covert schemes, as he sent his agents off to steal America's secrets, he did so determined to get vengeance for what a barbaric enemy had inflicted on his dear Libby and Ethel. In September 1996, Sasha, no longer a secret agent, just an old man getting used to his retirement, walked through the gravestones lined in orderly rows in Pine Lawn Cemetery on Long Island. It took him a while to find what he was searching for. It was a squarish gray stone, the name Rosenberg boxed with a black border. It bore two laconic inscriptions, carved parallel to one another. Ethel, born September 25, 1915, died June 19, 1953. Julius, born May 12, 1918, died June 19, 1953. There is a Russian custom to leave some soil taken from one's home on the grave of loved ones buried on distant shores. The gesture is meant to demonstrate that neither the many miles nor the expanse of oceans can separate the departed from the strong pull they continue to have on the heart. In a small bag, Sasha had a handful of soil he had gathered from under an apple tree at his dacha, and he now spread the rich brown earth in front of the gravestone. Standing at attention, he spoke as one soldier to two others. "Julius and Ethel," he began formally. "Here I am at your graves to pay my respect." But his voice broke as he continued, "Forgive us for not having known how to save your lives," he pleaded. When he was done, he still couldn't bring himself to leave. He stood there, hoping that somehow they had heard him, and somehow across the blackness of time and space they could convey to him that he was forgiven. It was that same year when Bob and Meredith, both also in retirement, met up for dinner in a French restaurant in Washington. Bob was living in Arizona, playing a lot of golf, and Meredith, who had his notebooks and the London Times crossword puzzle to keep him busy, had moved to a condominium a short drive from the restaurant. Meredith came with Blanche, and Bob brought his fourth wife, Martha, an elegant southern lady he had married in 1985. The marriage to his third wife had been, by mutual agreement, a short-lived mistake. It was to be a social occasion, Bob had promised Martha, just two old friends sharing a friendly evening. He had told her not to worry, they wouldn't be going on about the past. But Martha felt her husband must have known they'd get around to it. They wound up talking about nothing else, and Martha felt very estranged. She was not, as she'd tell people, Bob's FBI wife. Names were being thrown around that meant nothing to her. She'd never paid too much attention to politics, she explained defensively. Her recollections of the entire evening were vague. Except for one small incident that left her puzzled at the time, and still stuck sharply in her memory years later. It was toward the end of the meal, and Bob had looked across the table at Meredith and spontaneously raised the glass of scotch he'd been nursing. "A toast to old times," her husband had proposed. "To what we accomplished." Meredith raised his wine glass as if to clink against Bob's, but abruptly he hesitated. Then he lowered his glass. Bob slowly placed his back on the table, too. The two men sat across from each other, staring, gripping their glasses tightly as if in anger, as a leaden silence descended between them. What, Martha would always wonder, was that all about? Notes on Sources. On a brisk late October day in 2005, John F. Fox, the studious Ph.D. who served as the FBI's official historian, stood at the podium at the annual Symposium on Cryptological History and launched into a riveting presentation. One man, he began, was tall, thin, a genius linguist at the NSA who was working on breaking coded telegrams sent from Soviet offices in the U.S. to Moscow. The other was a lawyer and cop, a young FBI supervisor recently transferred to headquarters. Nearly a decade later, I received the transcript of this short speech describing the unique working partnership of Bob Lamphere, an FBI counterintelligence agent, and Meredith Gardner, the man who recreated the KGB codebook. It had been sent my way by a friend in the intelligence community who presciently thought there might be a bigger story here. After my initial reading, I knew he was right. Here was a true-life espionage tale, a story of two very different and very unlikely friends who had teamed up to chase down the most consequential spy ring in American history, the atomic spies. And it was also the story of one of the nation's great but barely known intelligence triumphs, the long-running secret operation hidden away at a former school for well-bred young women in Virginia that had cracked the unbreakable Russian codes. It was a tale I quickly realized I wanted to tell, and I began my own hunt to get at the previously unknown heart of the story and the people who had lived it. This book is the result of that investigation. It is a narrative, non-fiction spy tale. It has no ambitions to be a scholar's button-down, footnoted tome. Still, it is no less a true story. It is no less a history. It is no less buttressed by a firm foundation of facts. My covenant with the listener is this. When I relate certain events in this drama, whether on the world stage, behind the closed doors of secret intelligence, or in the minds and hearts of my characters, They are the products of the historical record and my research. They can be substantiated by official government records, documents, and reports. Bookshelves filled with volumes of Cold War histories, memoirs, personal notebooks, contemporaneous newspaper reports, previously transcribed conversations, and, not least, lengthy interviews I conducted with the close relatives of the main actors in this story. Bob Lamphere and Meredith Gardner are deceased. Therefore, when quotation marks enclose any dialogue in this book, this is an indication that at least one of the principals was the source. Further, when a character reveals what he is thinking or feeling, I will have found this too in a memoir, a letter, a notebook, a transcript of a previously published conversation, or an interview. Here, then, are some of the sources that helped me shape this story. It is a select, certainly not exhaustive, list, merely the key books and interviews that I relied on most often as I crafted this account. They are shared with the hope that any listener who continues to be curious about the tense Cold War spy versus spy chess game I've described, or how I went about its molding, will find them to be rewarding starting points for further exploration. At its narrative heart, this is a story about people who made history. Bob Lamphere's candid account, written with Tom Schachtman, of his career at the FBI and his friendship with Meredith Gardner was invaluable. The FBI-KGB War, a Special Agent Story, New York, Random House, 1986. I also relied on his voluminous FBI field personnel files, which Dr. Fox, the FBI historian whose insightful presentation had started my quest, kindly helped me obtain. I interviewed Bob's nephew, Theo Schad, who wrote the self-published family history, A Lamphere Anthology, and Bob's sister-in-law, Phyllis Lamphere. They also provided several of the photographs reproduced in this book. And I sat in an apartment in Richmond, Virginia, and spoke at length with Bob's gracious and elegant widow, Martha. Further, Richard Rhodes, whose own magisterial histories of the events surrounding the manufacture of both the atomic and the hydrogen bomb were essential sources throughout the writing of this book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, New York, Simon & Schuster Paperbacks, 2012, and Dark Sun, New York, Touchstone, 1996, has posted the transcript of the thoughtful, wide-ranging interview he'd conducted in Arizona with a long-retired Bob Lamphere in three parts on the web, Voices of the Manhattan Project, www.manhattanprojectoralvoices.org/oral-histories/robert-lamphere-interview. Bob Lamphere also appeared in an on-screen interview in the PBS program Secrets, Lies, and Atomic Spies, which first aired on February 5, 2002, www.pbs.org/wgbh/nova/transcript/2904_venona.html. Meredith Gardner was too guarded to publish a memoir. However, I met with his son, Arthur, and daughter-in-law, Michelle, in their comfortable home in Wisconsin, and they told me many insightful stories about him and Blanche, his wife. They also generously shared letters, postcards, and the truly fascinating gray notebooks Meredith had kept over the years as a sort of diary of his thoughts and widely varied interests. The Gardner family photographs that are reproduced here were graciously provided by them. Other insights into Meredith's work and personality can be found in Peter Wright, Spycatcher, The Candid Autobiography of a Senior Intelligence Officer, New York, Viking, 1987. Robert Louis Benson and Michael Warner editors, Venona, Soviet Espionage and the American Response, 1939 through 1957, Washington, D.C., National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, 1996, and several documents the NSA had posted on its website, including William Crowell's Remembrances of Verona, www.theblackvault.com/document/NSA/Venona/Venona_